Welcome to Cosmere Considered. Today I want to talk to you about The Lost Metal, Waxen Wayne 4, Mistborn Book 7 or 8, Mistborn Era 2, Book 4. You know the one that Brandon told us he was going to write after finishing Oathbringer? Spoiler warning for this one includes all of Mistborn, all of Stormlight, Mistborn Secret History, maybe Alamance Jack in the Pits of Eltania, and possibly Warbreaker? Get ready for some crazy theories, recaps, character opinions, death threats, though not to you, dear listener. And of course, the deeper meanings, messages, and intricacies hidden, or sometimes in plain view, in Brandon Sanderson's Cosmere. Alright, we're going to go on through a recap through the Mistborn books, because I want to make sure you know exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about it. So here we go. On the planet Skadriel, where the ash and mists keep the sky in the permanent stage of teenage rebellious grunge phase because the sun is so close it would kill you if you got sunburned, there is a man who smiles. Kelsier, the survivor and escapee of the ultimate prison, the pits of Hath-Sin, has gone insane. In a good way. Kelsier got together a team. The team consisted of Kelsier and Vin, the assassins. Vin's alter ego, Valette, the court spy. Sazed, the rebellious, but not really that much. Eunuch, Terrasmin, Doxin, the clerk. Ham, the friendly, punchy guy. Clubs, the grumpy soldier. Breeze, the politician. And Les, the Borns, a.k.a. Spook. From here on out, the group will be known as the Ashen Avengers. The Ashen Avengers concoct a plan to overthrow the Lord Ruler, who rules within an aluminum fist of racism and superiority. With a healthy dose of schizophrenia and a case of goddamn living for 1,000 years really can make you go crazy in new and exciting ways. Long story short, the Ashen Avengers win. They kill the God Emperor, Kelsier dies, and civil war begins as different kings try and take position as Emperor. Kelsier's death starts a religion known as Survivorism, and his ghostly visage appears to many after his death. Surprise, it wasn't a ghost, but a shape-shifting Chandra. More on that later. Turns out that the Lord Ruler, although morally deficient and horrible, was keeping the planet from being consumed by the universal constant of entropy, known as Ruin, a fractional god of infinite power that wants to destroy the planet because this is what happens to all things. The clock winds down, the contract is due, the sun is set. Meanwhile, in the land of mortals, Ellen Venture has joined the main stage as Vin's love interest and the king of capital city Luthadel. Various politics ensue and Ellen is ousted as king. An army of ogre-like blue-skinned anime sword-wielding monsters besieges the city, and Dox, Club, and Tindwheel, that's Sazed's love interest, all die. The city is saved when Vin freaking kills so many people and monsters. She then figures out how to mind control the blue monsters known as Kolos and crowns her husband Ellen Emperor. Oh, also Vin had a talking, shape-shifting wolfhound pet thing, and a weird romance with a crazy dude who dies, Rip Ellen's cousin, what's his name. At the end of the book, she follows these pulses of power and finds the Well of Ascension, which she and Sazed have been researching. She and Ellen reach the well, and Vin takes the power upon herself, but she does the heroic thing and lets the power go. Turns out that God is really, and I mean a really good liar. And the release power frees Ruin from his prison that was keeping him from destroying the world. A race against Ragnarok ensues as the end of the world starts off with a bang. Ellen eats a bit of Loracium and turns into a super powerful assassin. They search across the country looking for Atium and food and a way to stop the world from ending. Eventually, they have conquered most of the known world, but Spook leads a rebellion in Erto, like a discount Venice where the canals have all been drained of water. Because some racist dude is killing people there, kidnapping people, and he has a hot sister, Vin and Ellen find the fantasy equivalent of a neo-Nazi running a city quite well, honestly. It is at this point that we discover Kelsier is not entirely dead. He's only mostly dead. You see, he was playing cards, he was cheating, and someone killed him. Oh, wait, that's another thing. It turns out that Kelsier is what is known as a cognitive shadow. He exists almost entirely in the cognitive realm, a world that exists in the same space as the physical realm, but in a parallel dimension. From the cognitive realm, Kelsier has been pulling strings here and there. He steals something we will call the God Beacon from the aliens known as the Eisri. He saves Spook's life, and he sets plans in motion to save the world. It is at this point that God dies, not the god Ruin, but his counterpart, Preservation, or Laris. In a moment of grief and exhilaration, Kelsier uses the God Beacon, and then takes all of Preservation's power upon himself. He ascends and becomes God. Kelservation combats Ruin, keeps the world from dying completely, and helps Vin defeat the near-immortal, murderous pawns of Ruin known as the Steel Inquisitors. But it is all for naught. The world is still ending until Kelsier gives up his godhood and lets Vin take the power upon herself. Preservation and the power of love destroy Ruin as Elend dies. Ruin cannot keep himself alive because his physical form, the metal known as Atium, has been consumed by powerful super soldiers fighting for truth, justice, and the God I really don't want to die way. As the powers of the gods mingle in the sky, Sazed, the studier of religion, the teacher, the eunuch, the meek, the powerful, the loved, the grieved.
The hero of ages.
Steps forth and combines the powers, taking both of them upon himself and becoming a new god, Harmony. He rebuilds the world anew, and Series 1 of Mistborn comes to a close. There you have it, the end of Book 3 of Mistborn. Wow, what a conclusion. God is now hermaphrodite, your two favorite characters are now dead, but the world is saved and no kaiju battle had to take place. So you think, geez, Brandon sure did a bang-up job. I can't wait to see what happens next in this storyline. How will Spook, Brace, and Hammond build a new world? Will Damu keep Kelsier's memory alive? What happened to the Chondra? All of these questions will churn in your brain as you pick up the next Mistborn book. Too bad for you. The start of the next book will hit you like a freight train that was invented in the 300-year span between the Hero of Ages and the Alloy of Law. That's right. 300 years. Just like with the Final Empire, the Alloy of Law opens with an exposition covering society, technology, and magic systems, as well as an example of just how dark and horrific Sanderson can be. Without any further ado, let's dive into our recap of Sherlock and the X-Men in the Wild Wild West. Our new protagonist, Waxillium Landry, and that's Breeze's descendant, is a sheriff in the Wild Wild Roughs. His deputy, Wayne, is an obsessive-compulsive kleptomaniac who can't use guns. Wax's wife dies in the prologue, and the story continues with his wife 5 months dead. Wax uses his superpowers of being a twin-born crasher, that's an allomantic pusher and a ferrochemical steel skimmer, and his multitude of guns to deal out justice and avoid social situations. But not only is Wax a socially anxious sheriff, he is also brilliant. He is a detective and chemist and philosopher, and this is very important, he is dirt poor. Well, not dirt poor, maybe. He is as poor as a rich person with all the right connections can be, while still being very poor, yet having enough money to be rich. He lacks funds, meaning he needs a marriage for wealth, and here we meet the two main women of the series, Maracy and Steris. Half-sisters to the same dirty father, neither are who they pretend to be, and yet are both completely more than they appear to be. Maracy wants to use gentrification to fix poverty, and laws and regulations to end crime. She studies at university to become as powerful as possible, since all her life she has been told she is useless. Steris is, by her own admission, a dreadful bore. She wants nothing more than to appear normal. She just wants life to go exactly as she has carefully planned out in her 36-volume-per-year life plan. However, everything I just told you about these two women is backwards. By the end of Book 3, we know that neither of them actually want what they say they want. They both want adventure, heroism, usefulness, and the long, slender barrel of a certain lawman, firing bullets to kill the bad guys that always seem to attack them. In the Alloy of Law, Wax faces off against the Vanishers Gang, a well-armed and well-funded group of thugs led by Miles Hundredlives, which, as an aside, is the coolest wanted poster name ever, meaning he's basically immortal. He takes multiple shots to the face and regrows his skull in seconds, and pain is a distant memory to him. The Set, which we know employs Waxillium's supposed-to-be-dead uncle, Edworn, is kidnapping female Allomancers in the hopes of, well, making them have children and breeding allomantically active babies that they can harvest via hemallergy. I told you, this gets dark.
In Book 2, Shadows of Self, we learn about Lessie and Wax's first two meetings and get to see just how in over his head Wax was at 20 years old. Back to present time, about 20 years later, Wax is a deputized lawman of the city of Ellendale. He's still engaged to Steris. Steris is falling steadily in love with Wax, and Maracy is the Constable General's assistant, and Wayne is still, well, just Wayne, pining after the lesbian gunsmith, Renette. Trouble arises when Wax sees the face of his wife's murderer on the city streets. The main problem there is that Bloody Tan was expertly shot in the head of Wax, right after Tan forced Wax to kill his wife. After a conversation with Harmony and a team-up with Milan the Chondra, the hunt is on for Bleeder, an ancient and deadly Chondra that has gone insane. Using hemallergy to steal ferrochemical and allomantical powers from her victims, Bleeder begins to topple the city. She ousts the Chondra as spies for Harmony and the nobility. She kills corrupt officials and gangsters, and she shows that even the governor is corrupt. Then it turns out the governor was actually Bleeder for quite some time, and Wax chases Bleeder through the streets to put an end to her terror. On a bridge spanning one of the great canals of the city, Bleeder removes her face mask and reveals that she has used her powers to turn her face into the face of Wax's dead wife. Wax shoots her in the head, and since Chondra don't die from bullet wounds, Bleeder takes the bullet to the face without flinching. But what Bleeder didn't know was that Wax had used a hemorrhagic spike to make that bullet, and with two spikes now inside her oozy flesh, Harmony starts to take control of Bleeder's body once again. In a moment of desperation, Bleeder ends her own life in a way only Chandra can, but before she dies, she admits to Wax that she had loved him on the day they first met. To his horror, Wax slowly realizes that the Chandra, Bleeder, had been his wife all along. Racked with guilt and hatred towards Harmony and the Chandra, Wax falls into a stupor, and the only one who can seem to do the right thing is his fiancée, Steris. In Book 3, The Bands of Mourning, that's M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, as in sad, not M-O-R-N-I-N-G, as in the sunrise, we catch up with Wax and Steris on the morning of their wedding. Wax is nervous, but ready to go through with it. Steris is excited, and from a reader's perspective, very in love with Wax. The wedding is upended when a rooftop water tower floods the church. It's at that point that a Chandra, one of the faceless immortals of Harmony, approaches Wax with a quest to rescue the missing blessing, a hemorrhagic spike that has been taken from Relur, the Chandra. After some politicking, Marisi, Wax, Steris, Wayne, and Milan, the Chandra, head south to the city of New Sarah. Wax, in search of his uncle Edwarn, Soot Ladrian, and his sister Telsin. Marisi, in search for the spike. On the way there, lots of classic spaghetti western stuff happens. Marisi shoots a dude in the head and splatters his brains all over one of the hostages he'd taken. Wax and Steris discuss sex and taxes. The train is robbed, and of course, Wayne and Milan have a good snogging. During the course of the fight, one of the bad guys, later named as Professor Eirik, uses an adamantic grenade to stop Wax's heroic efforts. He loses the grenades to Marisi as the fight disrupts the train. Once in the city, the party splits up, and Hoyd shows his face, giving Waxilim a metal coin, just as he, Steris, and Milan, wearing his 100% aluminum body, crash the party of Lady Kelesina. Wax pays an informant for some local knowledge, and then overhears his uncle discussing a clandestine location to the north of the city. Wax is discovered, and chaos erupts as they are all nearly captured and or killed, but with some quick thinking from Steris and some quality gunplay from Wax, they escape. Marisi and Wayne head to the bank, and then a graveyard where they're nearly killed and or exploded. The whole party regroups and flees the city as the constables try and capture them, as Wax is framed for the murder of Lady Kelesina. As they ride the stagecoach through the outer fields of the Great Basin, Marisi tests the alamantic grenade she found on the train, and Wayne finds an unkeyed gold metal mine with tons of healing stored in it. These two seemingly impossible inventions excite the group as they speed towards the set's first site. They arrive in the dead of night at a huge open-topped warehouse. Using the unpatented and unorthodox crushed tomato technique, they make their way into the factory. Inside, they find a giant ship in the middle of it, and many guards, engineers, and alamancers surrounding it. Wax and Wayne rescue Wax's sister, Telsin. Marisi and Milan secure the alamantic spike taken from Relur, and Marisi finds a masked man in a cage. The masked man, who we later find out is named Aleg, is from a group of people who wear masks for most of, if not all of, their lives. He and his companions have been captured and tortured by the set, and only Aleg is still alive. Marisi, Milan, Aleg, Telsin, Wax, and Wayne make their way into the giant ship in the middle of the open-topped warehouse, and Aleg does something truly amazing. Aleg takes the alamantic grenade, and once charged by Wax's ability, he uses it like a key to make a lifeboat break away from the giant ship. But this isn't a ship of water and waves. Oh no, this is a ship of the sky. The skimmer takes off into the air and begins flying away from the set's encampment, and after a quick detour to pick up Steris from her hiding place, the skimmer heads into the mountains towards the second site. On the way through the air to the second site, Aleg explains the powerful medallions that the mask people use to give themselves ferrochemical and alamantical abilities. A clever combination of nicrosil and other metals let anyone touching the metal draw upon its power without having any innate powers of their own. Upon arriving at the snow-covered entrance to a mountaintop temple, the party idles by a massive statue of a man holding a spear. The man is spiked through one eye by a hemorrhagic spike like the Inquisitors of old, and his face is imposing as he looks out over the mountains. Wayne, of course, can't help himself, so he steals the spearhead from the statue, unscrewing it off like a bolt. In the temple, the team quickly sets to dealing with the traps left by Aleg's people's progenitor, the Sovereign, who Marisi believes to be the Lord Ruler, a place to keep the Bands of Mourning safe, and a challenge to his people, the Malwish. Soot shows up with his veritable army of sadistic, insane followers, and they besiege our troop of heroes. The heroes know their only way out is through, so they go to discover the Bands of Mourning with Soot in tow, since he knows the secret sequence to open the vault door at the back of the trapped corridor. Once inside, they find an empty pedestal surrounded by broken glass. The Bands of Mourning are missing. In this moment, Soot knows he doesn't need Wax or his friends anymore, so guns are drawn. Surprisingly, Telsin levels an alamantic pistol at Wax and shoots him in the neck, just as she alamantically pushes his bullet off its lethal track towards her head. Marisi, Steris, and Aleg are captured, and Milan is turned into a mist wraith with both her blessings removed. Wayne escapes, and Wax tumbles down a pit trap to escape his uncle and ends up in a squat cave with only the faintest of filtered light reaching it. There, in the middle of the ruin, surrounded by the Sovereign's frozen dead priests, sit the Bands of Mourning. Wax makes his way towards them, but Edwarn catches him and activates a rock trap that crushes Waxilium under a literal mountain of stone. But even as Edwarn basks in victory, he finds that these bands of power are empty, used up and useless. He hikes out of the cave and into the snow.
Meanwhile, Steris frees herself, Alig, and surprisingly, the other surviving members of Alig's ship's crew from the captors and starts a firefight with the Set's lackeys. Marisi takes a moment to berate herself for her uselessness before realizing that the temple was all a lie. All of it was a ruse sent to distract the power-hungry adventurers from the truth. The bands of mourning weren't literal bands at all. The metal had been folded together and fastened into a single, solid spearhead. The same spearhead that Marisi had in her purse after taking it from Wayne, who had removed it from the statue of the Sovereign. Marisi takes up the spearhead and, tapping massive stores of all of the useful elements, she lays waste to multiple members of the Set. She then flings herself into the temple and puts the spearhead into Wax's cold dead hands. During all of this, Wax has been having the most interesting conversation with our dear friend Harmony. After this conversation, Wax chooses to return to his life on the planet Scadrial instead of venturing into the great beyond in search of his wife. He draws in the healing power of gold from the Bands of Mourning and decimates the Set. Many of them have made it into the giant crashed warship of the Malwish, including Soot. So Wax flies aboard the giant flying ship, and due to careful maneuvering and the threat of bombs exploding, they western-style duel each other. Wax kills Soot and lands the ship, saving the day. Wayne shoots Telson in the face with a shotgun, which is a big moment for him. Remember, he doesn't like guns. But she heals and gets away in the small ship, and the whole party returns to Ellendale aboard the giant flying ship. They leave the Bands of Mourning in the care of Ten Soon and the Chondra, and start a tense peace relationship between the Ellendalians and the Malwish. The Malwish leave in their ship. Wax and Steris have a private, quick, and quiet ceremony, because Wax and Steris are very much in love. Then the Sanderlanch arrives with crushing brutality as Soot is executed by a faceless immortal suicide bomber. Not a conjurer of Harmony, oh no, but an immortal servant of Trell. In another section of the city, Wax wakes from his slumber next to his new wife and plays with a coin given to him by Hoyd a few days ago in New Saren. As he holds it, he realizes it is made of two metals, and once he realizes to look for it, he draws the memory out of the copper mine of the coin. Waxillium sees a snow-covered barren landscape through the eyes of a man with one eye spiked through, the blue lines of Alamancy making up half his vision as the scene unfolds. The dead lying around the outskirts of a town, a dim fire made of burning masks sparking fitfully in the middle of a small hut. People huddled around the fire for warmth, looking with wide eyes at the stranger in their midst. In Waxillium's mind, in the copper mine's memory, a hand reaches toward the huddled figures, a battered and scarred hand, with long, thin, silvery white scars crisscrossing the arm up to the elbow, and a single word spoken as a command. Survive! This is where we will pick up with our next installment of Mistborn. More points. One is that Marsh, Kelsia's brother from the first trilogy, is still alive and has a splinter religion of his own. He is referred to as Iron Eyes and is seen as Harmony's agent of death. At the end of the Alloy of Law, he brings Marisi and Wax a copy of Lester Bornus's book on Hemallergy. The second thing is that throughout the book series, it is first hinted at and then directly told to us that an alien force is attempting to invade the planet. The men of red and gold are coming. The god Trell is coming to the planet to destroy Harmony, and Harmony can feel the malevolence of the invaders. Now, I'm just going to dive into general discussion here, and we're going to touch both on Stormlight and Mistborn book Era 2 Book 4, because, you know, all of this kind of comes together. So, really what I want to get into first is who is Trell and what is Trell's goal. Now, there's two main theories that I've seen, and there's a third that I'll just say real quick. The third one is it's the 16th shard. So the one shard we don't have a name for yet, following Stormlight Book 4. So shard 16 is here, and this is where we will be introduced to them. The second one that I think is a little more likely, definitely than the first one, is that it is in fact Odium. Now, if you haven't read Stormlight Book 4, you're going to want to stop here. But if you had read Book 4, we know Todium is set to duel Dalinar. I believe that Dalinar, in this theory, Dalinar will lose the duel, and Todium will be freed from the Stormlight system, from the Rosharan system, and he will be going throughout the galaxy, trying to bring the other shards underneath his power and splinter them so that he is the only one left. It makes sense. Red and gold are Odium's colors, so it just makes sense in that way that it would be Odium coming to destroy, and it fits in the timeline. We know that Wax and Wayne Era 2 takes place after Stormlight Book 5, so there is that opportunity there for it to fit. Now, the third theory is the one that I think is the most likely, and it is that Trell is actually the god, or the, I suppose you could say, the fractional god Autonomy. Now, and if you don't know, Autonomy is the god of the planet from White Sand, and White Sand, the planet that White Sand takes place on, is tidally locked. One side of the planet is all desert and constantly has the sun shining down on it. The other side is a dark, beautiful jungle that has a small white dwarf and lots of other stars on its side. To me, that sounds an awful lot like how Trell is described in the first Mistborn era. You have the eyes of Trell looking on at night, the many, many eyes, and then the one eye of his jealous brother on the other side. So right there, we see a little connection to Trell and Autonomy from their different worlds and different times. And then if we look at what Autonomy wants and what Harmony wants, and the presence of Book 2 in this quadrilogy. A lot of people have talked about how Mistborn Era 2 is Sanderson's weakest set of books. They're still very strong, but they seem like they're just not as up there as the rest of his work. They're weaker than the first Mistborn books. And generally, Sanderson's writing has been getting better and better as he does it more and more. Sanderson himself even talks quite lowly about Elantris and the mistakes he made there, and he's seeking to redeem himself in these books. So I think it's very possible that because Book 2 is about God leading you around by the nose. I mean, the entire plotline of Shadows of Self is Bleeder, Wax's wife, Lessie, trying to overthrow God's control and establish free will in an actual real sense. And Harmony meets with Wax at the end of every book and talks to him about how, or at some point during the books, talks to him about how this is Harmony's plan. He's setting it in place. He's taking the steps to do this. And Milan says at one point, he is doing the best possible, the best anyone can, by definition. And one of the reasons that I think this works so well for it being Autonomy is that if Autonomy is the enemy, if Autonomy is Trell, then that's very much what Autonomy is against. Autonomy is against being led around by the nose. Autonomy is about free will and doing it on your own. And Harmony has created this beautiful basin of strength and power. He has given these, the Elendelians kind of crazy power structure of God giving them pretty much too much, and yet it's turned on their heads. And Autonomy sees that. He says, you've given them everything, and you still have poor, you still have sick, you still have dying. It's not worth it. You need to change tactics. And we know Autonomy is active in the universe. We know that on the island of Patchy, in the novella Sixth of the Dusk, that shard there, that piece of, it's not a shard, but that piece of Adonalsium, is Autonomy. It's an avatar of Autonomy. And so we know that Autonomy is active and trying to have more and more influence in, throughout the Cosmere. So it makes sense that Trell is Autonomy, and Trell is hoping to, oust Sazed. And one of the theories that I also see is that as Sazed leeches out or brings into existence his physical body, Atium, and his physical body, Laracium, and his physical body, a new element, Harmonium, those three elements coming back into existence or being consumed by him to make his physical form, if one of those scales becomes tipped, he's going to become, disharmonic. He's going to become discordant, and he would become discord. He wouldn't be harmony, he'd be discord. And I think one thing to think about that is that, if Trell's people have, a lot of Atium, this lost metal, hidden, and they give it, they force it upon Sazed, upon Harmony at the wrong time or at the right time, he'll lose the battle in himself of Harmony, and he will become more ruin than preservation. The balance will tip, and it will weaken him enough for, for Trell to come in and, dethrone him. along with all that, not on the scale of gods, but on the scale of people, one of the things Brandon mentioned in a July update, a July 2021 update, is that Wax and Wane is kind of broken into four parts. The first part, you're following around Wax and Steris. I'm assuming they have a child, or, you know, she's going to be given birth, because we haven't had a protagonist with a young child yet, besides, you know, like Dalinar, you know, flashbacks, but we haven't had the mother have a child yet, and that is a big thing. Sanderson is very about inclusivity, and he's trying to show different people in different stages of life with different beliefs and different desires, and so of course this is his chance to give us that. And, you know, story reasons as well, Steris and Wax are both older and they need an heir, so they're going to be getting busy, and there's going to have been a time skip, a minimum of 6 months to probably a year and a half maximum. So that gives us enough time to have them to have had a kid, or for the baby being born to be the first thing that happens in the book. I could definitely see that being a, like the prologue is, you know, Wax is out on a job, on a case, he's doing something, he's fighting for the city, maybe trying to stop the civil war from happening, and Wane is like, hey, you know, we just got the letter, you need to get to your wife, she's having the baby. And, you know, Wax gets out of there to go meet his child. And I think that's definitely a possibility, because the first two prologues were also about him and his wife. So it would make sense if it continued in that vein. So as Wax and Steris are doing their own thing, Wane and Marcy have something they're trying to accomplish. And then all four of them come together. Then they all break apart and have their own individual tasks, storylines written following them as individuals, and then they all come together for the conclusion. So he's talking about how he's writing it more like a Stormlight book, and it's going to be a little more intense for him to bring together, which is what he likes. And so I think it's going to really, really be the crown jewel of the Mistborn Era 2 books. It's going to bring us everything we want, especially with the Sander Lanch at the end, when we discover really who Trell is, what his plans are, and exactly what happens to Harmony. Because he threw us a curveball at the end of Rhythm of War with what happened to Odium, so no holds bar here now, Brandon. And then one thing I want to talk about is it's interesting to me that Sanderson has grown so much as an author. You know, he talks about how Elantris was not as good as it was in the past. Or Elantris is not as good as his new projects, and his new projects he puts more time and effort into, and he's just becoming a better and better writer as time goes on. And, you know, the next two Mistborn installments are kind of like an 80s, 90s hacker, you know, technology thing. And if we look at, you know, the comparison, this is like Mistborn Era 2 is 1870s to 1920s, and Mistborn Era 3 is supposed to be like 1970s to 2000s. What we're missing in that time skip between Era 2 and 3 is the space race, because we started flying in the 1920s. You know, the Wright brothers was, I think, believe 1922, and then in 1964, I believe. I'm probably wrong on that. We landed on the moon because it was in the 80s. Gosh, I'm super wrong. I know I'm super wrong about that. Those dates are totally wrong. There was 60 years. I know there's 60-something years between our first flights as man and landing on the moon. You can look that up. It's super common knowledge. I'm sure someone cares enough to tell me I'm wrong about that. But, you know, we're missing the space race, and then we come into this hacker scene that's happening, and then after that, we're getting our space opera in the Mistborn books. And what's interesting to me is that he is setting up kind of all of this to culminate at the same time, right? You know, if he keeps writing books around the same speed he has been, we should be getting into the middle of Wax and Wane Trilogy 4, the space opera, at the end of the Stormlight series. And as all of that comes together, it's going to be pretty incredible. And one of the things that is happening in all the series is a shift from fantasy to sci-fi. And, you know, it keeps its roots in fantasy. People have magical abilities and things like that. But the magic is becoming a science, because, you know, as the old saying goes, magic is just science we don't understand. And as they understand it more and more and can control it more and more, Fabrials are leading towards a fantasy-built sci-fi universe. And we see that in the Stormlight books. In the first two books, we have Sadeas and Dalinar politicking, you know, secret daggers behind the back, kind of risk pieces on a board, more like chess. And, you know, in Mistborn Era 1, it's like assassins and castles and lords and ladies, and then we have the Industrial Revolution, and then we have the hacker, and then we have the space opera. And so we kind of expect this shift into sci-fi, and I just want to make sure that you, as a reader, have considered the fact that what Mistborn is becoming is not going to be what it was, and it is going to change, and the same thing is going to happen to Stormlight. And you know, that's something I think people may not be considering enough, because I've seen some complaints lately, and I just think, you know, think about that as we get ready for Wax and Wayne Book 4, because I bet the Sanderlanch is going to be something that turns you upside down. Because if we had our first flights, you know, I guess, what, 30 years ago for the Malwish, they could be flying into space at the end of this book, especially with invaders coming from space. It makes sense thematically, so keep that in mind. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. For this last little bit here, I'm just going to talk about kind of the greater significance of Wax's and Harmony's conversation. As I said, for this last section, I just want to talk about, you know, the deeper meanings, messages, and intricacies in these books in the Cosmere that I love. And you know, if you've been here before, that's what I like to do. I believe Sanderson does an amazing job of forcing us as readers or listeners, if you're an audiobook lover, to really ask yourself the important questions. Now, you can read his books kind of just as fluff, get through them, enjoy them, and move on with your life. I really don't have that ability. I read them and it changes me. And the Wax and Wayne books have done this more than any of his other books. You know, the Stormlight books are great. There's a lot of mental health issues in there. You know, I have a lot of in common with Shallan as an artist and a creator who deals with childhood abuse. You know, I don't have dissociative identity disorder or anything like that. But I do have depression like Kaladin, and I live in Washington State, so seasonal affective disorder like he has is really a pain. And you know, I have PTSD. And so, you know, that has been great from the Stormlight archive. But, you know, I was raised as a Christian. I believe in God. You know, I don't have the same faith as Sanderson, but I am a Christian. And the theological questions that he poses and the theological answers he provides through some of his characters are, for me, some of the best theological writing to come out in the last few years. And I just kind of want to dive into that for a minute. You know, in book one, in The Alloy of Law, he talks about how, you know, Wax is fighting and he prays to Harmony. And he says, you know, could you send a little help? Give me a little help. And, you know, then Sazed says, a little is what I gave. I gave you a little help. That's what you said. And it's kind of this moment of, you know, be specific with your prayers. You could have asked for a lot of help, and I might have done something differently. But it's, you know, that's kind of something we see a lot in Christianity. One of the other things that I find very interesting is the idea of when Kelsier says, you know, do something. Why don't you just do something, damn it? And Harmony says, I did. I sent you. I moved all the pieces in place so that you would go. I sent you as my agent to do my goodwill. And that's, you know, something that we also see a lot in Western Christianity, is that, you know, the man's standing on his roof during a hurricane and the boat comes by and he says, no, I'm waiting for God. You don't need to rescue me. And then the helicopter comes by and he says, no, I'm waiting for God. He'll rescue me. And then the man drowns and he appears in heaven and he says, God, what the heck? And God says, I sent you a helicopter and a boat. What do you want me to, what else do you want me to do? And so it's kind of idea that you are an agent of God. Every person has the ability to be an agent of God, and some people are more so than others. You know, if we look at the Bible, there's something like less than a dozen people in the Bible are directly sent by God to do something. You know, most of the time it's just them acting and him being a part of the story. And so to me, that's an interesting thing to consider, is Wax is one of those few, and so is Mercy, you know, directed by God. Except in the Wax and Wayne world, it's very possible that Harmony is leading everyone around by the nose, or a majority of people, and that most people are NPCs without knowing it. And really no one is an adventurer, which of course brings us back to why my theory from earlier that the Of course, Autonomy is trying to unseat Harmony for the control he's putting over all of his people. And, you know, that's just something, as a Christian, I love to consider, has God sent me to do something? Have I been sent to do this? When I see an injustice in the world, is it my place to take care of it? I say the answer is yes. If you see an injustice, it is your place to help with that. You know, all that it takes for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. And so, you know, Wax does something, Wayne does something, Maracy, Steris, they do something. They take action. And, you know, Sanderson's books encourage me in that. And then I get to book two, and I look at Milan's conversation with Maracy, or Maracy, however you pronounce her name. And Maracy says, you know, couldn't Harmony just, you know, lie? Couldn't you just pretend to be the governor and we can, you know, we know he's wrong? And, you know, she kind of blows up, you know, she starts yelling at Maracy and is like, oh, you just prefer that Harmony lead us all around by the nose, like Pa'alm was so convinced that he does. And, like, just starts yelling at her and is like, he does the best possible by the very definition. Because he is God, he is doing as good of a job as possible. And this is kind of the counter argument to the, you know, if God is all good and all knowing, then he's not all powerful. And if God is all powerful and all knowing, then he's not all good. Kind of that argument that a lot of anti-believers or people who are arguing against Christianity or other faiths say is that, you know, God isn't all powerful, all good, and all knowing. Otherwise, the world wouldn't be so dark. And it's like, yes, but he's providing free will. And, you know, with the provision of free will, he has to allow for some left and some right leaning from perfection, because brokenness comes from free will. You know, that is how the world works. And for me, this was a huge moment to consider, like, yes, our world is broken, but we have, you know, we are moving forward in the best possible way. You know, like the way I view God in our world is that he is providing us with free will at the cost of free will. And sometimes that cost is dark and horrific and terrible and horrible. And sometimes, you know, that free will is just, oh, so worth it. And that's kind of the argument that's happening in these books. And so it adds more fuel to the fire for why I think Autonomy is going to be the final bad guy in these books. And then, you know, in book three, when Wax is having his conversation with Harmony, you know, while he's kind of waiting to die, he's in that in-between place. You know, they talk about God not knowing what's beyond, because God hasn't died, and so God hasn't been there, and so, of course, God doesn't have that knowledge. It is outside of him. And, you know, it's just interesting to see the limits Sanderson places on his gods in his books. And it just makes me consider that in quite a deep way. And, you know, Wax there, you know, he kind of yells at Sazed. And I believe that is the point where he says, why don't you do something? And Sazed said, I sent you to do something. And we know from Harmony's letter to Hoyd, written in the little four words for every chapter in Rhythm of War, that Harmony is preparing a soldier. And we know book four takes place before Wax and Wayne, and so it could be that Wax is one of these soldiers Harmony is preparing to fight for him, one of the pieces he's putting on the board. And the truth is, Harmony could be creating hundreds. Wayne, Maracy, Steris, you know, Pa'alm could have been one of his chess pieces. Tensun, Milan, all of these people, you know, even side characters we've met. Soot, for goodness sake, could even be someone that Harmony has tried to put in place as a person of action for the greater good. And at some point, free will has taken them off the course. And it makes me consider my own life and my place in this world. And, you know, whether or not you believe in God, do you believe in the fact that you could be in a place to do good and have chosen to do bad, chosen to, you know, in a biblical sense, sin rather than follow grace and follow, you know, justice and faith and all that? And have you damaged God's plan. Well, not really. You can't damage God's plan because he is God in our world. In the Wax and Wayne books, it very much so, I believe, is getting in Harmony's way. And I honestly don't think Harmony will last to the end of the four books. But back to the deep thoughts, it really makes me consider just quite, you know, how important I am in the grand scheme of things. I am important. You know, a lot of people say, like, in the grand scheme of things, you're not important. You're like, you're just one person. There are millions, billions, billions of people we do not know the name of. You know, raise a glass to all of the Neanderthals who ate all the plants to find out they were poisonous and they died instead of me. Like, millions and millions, billions and billions of humans that we don't know their names. And they were important in their time. And that's okay to admit. It's okay to say, I am important in God's plan. I am important in the universe's plan, however you want to view it. I can say with confidence, God has a place for me. Now, he might not be leading me around by the nose. He might not be moving me like a chess piece, but he does have use for me. And that use is to do good. That use is to do something. So, you know, as you listen to this, if anyone is listening to this, I just ask, consider that you are worthy of worth. You are capable of good, and that the universe or God, you know, God, in my belief, Jesus, has a place for you. And he might not, you know, say, go to Africa and dig a well and spread the word of the Lord and, you know, bring as much food and medicine as you can and raise these people to be decent humans and protect them from, you know, anyone that comes to try to steal from them and kind of turn things on its head and, you know, change the world in some way. You know, he's not saying, you know, head to the inner city of Philadelphia or Chicago or, you know, head to the slummest parts of, you know, I don't know, Kyrgyzstan and help people there. He says that to some people, I'm sure. I'm sure he has a place for those people. But for you, maybe it's say hi to that person at work that seems to, you know, be a lot. Not that any of us are working right now, so I don't know who you're going to say hi to from your Zoom meetings, but, you know, reach out to the neighbor, you know, bake cookies for a friend, you know, ask a question that you're afraid to ask because you're afraid of getting close to someone. You know, God has a place for you, and that place is simply to do good and to love and think about how you can move forward as that person. To go along with that, Wax is not an agent of harmony. He's an agent of harmony, but he's not an agent of preservation. He's an agent of ruin. Not everyone in our world is meant to be peaceful. There are great evils out there that need to be crushed and turned around. There are a lot of horrors in history, and I don't need to name them, but good needs to be done against evil. And I will say that, good needs to be done against evil. So if you see evil happening, take a step towards good and love. Do the right thing. Not always the peaceful thing, but always the right thing. Anyways, I know this was quite a long rant, but I just felt like I had a lot to say because these books have done so much to my heart, and my entire belief system has been kind of changed, not in a fundamental way, but in an emotional way from reading these books as I consider how Brandon has his characters, you know, connect with God and how I connect with God. And, you know, I just ask you to consider these things. Consider the Cosmere. Do good to each other. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time. Thank you.